From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Kevin Beasley. This week, the political effects of the murders in France, why Egypt's Bedouin have been kidnapping foreigners, and trying to save dogs in China. Police in France have been arresting suspected Islamist militants in the wake of a string of murders. The killing of three Jewish children, a rabbi, and three soldiers of North African descent has also had an impact on the French presidential campaign, where the issue of immigration was already a major theme. The gunman, a Frenchman of Algerian descent, was shot dead by police after a long standoff in the city of Toulouse. As NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports, his killing spree has prompted national soul-searching in France.
1 week after the massacre outside the Jewish school in Toulouse, the actions of 23-year-old Muslim extremist Mohamed Merah dominate television debates and cafe conversations, and issues of security and immigration have replaced jobs and the economy on the campaign trail. Far-right National Front Party candidate Marine Le Pen has unabashedly blurred the lines between terrorism and immigration as she toughens her rhetoric.
Combien de Mohamed Merah?
How many Mohamed Merahs are in the planes and the boats that arrive in France every day filled with immigrants? How many Mohamed Merahs are among the unassimilated immigrants living in total rupture with French values?
Now, some Muslims here, like Parisian Ben Chéri, say they fear a backlash. You can't confuse an Islamist with a Muslim, he says. God forbids the killing of innocents. We wholly condemn his crimes. France has Western Europe's largest Muslim and Jewish communities. French Jews have also been shaken by the tragedy. But there has been an outpouring of public outrage and solidarity. Silent marches in Paris and Toulouse, led by rabbis and imams walking arm in arm, attracted thousands of people. Some marchers carried signs in French, Hebrew, and Arabic calling for fraternité. Marek Alter is a prominent French-Jewish writer.
It's important to see all the people out here together. The anger is so huge that people had to come out. France is together today.
French President Nicolas Sarkozy said French Muslims were clearly not responsible for the acts of a madman. He noted that Merah also targeted Muslim soldiers. The French president ridiculed Le Pen's parallel between the killer and immigration, pointing out that Merah was born and raised in France. Sarkozy has chosen to focus on security. In a fiery stump speech over the weekend, the president told the crowd that his socialist opponent, François Hollande, had voted against French terror laws. He promised that if he were re-elected, tough new measures would go on the books. Sarkozy has proposed jail time for repeat visitors to websites preaching hatred and for those who go abroad for what he calls extremist indoctrination.
Talking about terrorism, jihad, and violence is not a matter of discussing an opinion. These ideas should be forbidden on French soil, and we will fight them.
The socialist frontrunner, François Hollande, asked how Merah could have obtained such an arsenal when handguns are illegal in France, and he called Sarkozy's law and order record a failure. There have been questions about whether French intelligence missed clues about Merah early on. Still, commentators have praised Sarkozy's handling of the tragedy. Standing next to the flag-draped coffins of the three soldiers at a funeral last week, Sarkozy appeared dignified and presidential. In a moving speech, he said the killer had not brought France to its knees as he intended.
La République n'a pas reculé. La République n'a pas faibli.
Just 2 months ago, Sarkozy lagged well behind Hollande. Now polls show the two contenders neck and neck for the April 22nd first-round vote in what is now one of the tightest presidential races many say they can remember. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
Coming up, why Egypt's Bedouin have been kidnapping foreigners and trying to save dogs in China. Bedouin tribesmen in Egypt's Sinai Peninsula rely on tourists for their livelihood. They take foreign visitors on safaris, they sell them trinkets, or they rent them huts along the shores of the Red Sea. But some Bedouin have started using tourists for something completely different, as hostages in a political battle with the Egyptian government. In the latest incident, the tribesmen kidnapped two Brazilian women in an attempt to secure the release of the Bedouins' imprisoned relatives. They released the tourists unharmed a few hours later. NPR's Soraya Sahadi Nelson sent this report from the Sinai Peninsula.
Earlier this year, Ahmed Hashem and scores of other Bedouin activists from his Kararesha tribe held a sit-in in the nearby town of Wadi Ferran in South Sinai. The 37-year-old sheikh says they wanted the Egyptian government to listen to their grievances. They plan to ask for running water in their homes and development projects to ease local unemployment. But Hashem says no official ever came. So they decided to force the government's hand by detaining two busloads of European tourists visiting a historic monastery in Wadi Ferran. Hashem says they blocked the gate and prevented the Westerners from leaving for 5 hours. A panicked police official at the site called his superiors. Hashem says the governor's security chief agreed to meet with them the next day, so he let the tourists go.
If we hadn't gotten the meeting we asked for, we would have taken the tourists to a secret location as punishment. Then the Egyptian government would have had to deal with the embarrassment.
Other members of Hashem's tribe targeted more tourists in the same area a few days later. They kidnapped two Americans and their Egyptian guide to win the release of jailed relatives. Tribal sheikhs intervened, and the Americans and their guide were released a few hours later. So was a group of South Korean tourists kidnapped last month by members of the same tribe. None of the Bedouin prisoners were released, nor were the Bedouin kidnappers arrested. Sheikh Maged Rabi is a Kararesha tribal leader who negotiated with the kidnappers. He is embarrassed by the attacks on tourists. Like many Bedouin here, he refers to them as accidents. But he adds his tribesmen don't feel they have a choice but to involve tourists in their battles with Egyptian authorities. They, like many Bedouin across Sinai, complain about receiving substandard services and education from the Egyptian government, which has also seized their lands. Ismail Alexandrani is an Egyptian researcher who specializes in the Bedouin. He says neglect was part of a plan by former President Hosni Mubarak to weaken Egypt's minorities to prevent dissent. His security forces dealt harshly with the Bedouin, raiding their homes and imprisoning them without cause. But the fall of the Mubarak regime weakened Egypt's security apparatus and gave the Bedouin a rare opportunity to fight back. Many are now heavily armed with weapons smuggled here from Libya and Sudan. It's not just tourists the Bedouin are targeting. Last week, hundreds of armed tribesmen surrounded a base in North Sinai where international troops are stationed to monitor compliance with the 33-year-old Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty. The gunmen were demanding the release of fellow tribe members they claim were falsely imprisoned for the 2005 bombings in the resort city of Sharm el-Sheikh. The Bedouin backlash has also led to an increase in violent crime in South Sinai. At this currency exchange store in Sharm el-Sheikh, a French tourist was killed and two other people were wounded when Bedouin robbers and police officers got into a firefight here in late January. An hour later, police shot dead a Bedouin taxi driver and wounded his friend. Authorities claim the two were involved in the robbery, although their relatives say that surveillance tape and fingerprints prove the two weren't involved. Farag Atek is the uncle of the dead taxi driver. He says he doesn't condone the recent kidnappings or violence, but that if his nephew doesn't receive justice, then, quote, there will be blood. The Bedouin actions and threats have been a headache for Egyptian officials already contending with a sharp decline in tourism since the revolution. More than 80% of foreign tourists who come to Egypt head for the beaches like those in Sinai. But only a few tourists were visible on a recent night in the main restaurant and shopping district outside Sharm el-Sheikh. South Sinai Governor Khaled Fouda says he's tried to defuse the crisis. He replaced the security chief and has urged police officials to treat the Bedouin with more respect. But he says the Bedouin must also work with the government to solve disagreements.
You know, the Bedouin is stubborn.
Leaders of South Sinai's tribes agree that better dialogue is needed. They recently formed a tribal union to boost their political power and serve as a sounding board for grievances. One of the leaders is Sheikh Ashish Anis. He says each tribe plans to create a committee to address their clan's grievances. He adds those committee members will also be held responsible if their tribes carry out any more kidnappings. Soraya Sarhadi Nelson, NPR News.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Kevin Beasley. A growing number of people in China are buying dogs as pets and treating them like family members. That's a change from the past, when Chinese were more likely to eat dogs, although some still do. That growing affection has recently taken a radical turn. Activists have been stopping trucks taking dogs to slaughter and bargaining with the truck drivers for the animals' release. NPR's Frank Langford has this report on China's growing animal rights movement.
Dai Wajing was driving in East China's Jiangsu province late last year when she saw a truck filled with dogs packed into cages like fur coats. The truck driver was negotiating a price with butchers at a roadside market.
The dogs' mouths and legs were tightly tied up and the cages were very, very small. They couldn't move. There was no space at all.
Dai grabbed her cell phone and began calling fellow animal lovers. The news ricocheted around Sina Weibo, China's most popular Twitter-like microblog. Within several hours, about 150 activists had surrounded the flatbed truck, demanding the animal's release. As negotiations dragged into the night, they used baby bottles to feed the dogs water and petted them through the rusting wire mesh. Video from the scene shows a woman telling a sad-looking mutt not to be afraid, he's going home. Eventually, the activists pooled nearly $8,000 and bought the dog's freedom. Dai said her decision to confront the dog meat sellers was instinctive.
I think it was a very natural thing to do. It was their truck, and a truckload of dogs would be sent to be butchered. So the first thing I had to do was to stop it.
Over the past year, animal lovers have stopped eight other dog meat sellers along China's roadways and rescued an estimated 2,000 dogs. Dog meat is legal here, but a growing number of Chinese want to ban it. It's part of a shift in attitudes towards animals in China, driven by rising incomes, urbanization, and increased pet ownership. To appreciate the changes, ride with the volunteers who travel by bus every other week to the shelter where the dogs Dai helped rescue now live. Along the way, they put on plastic gloves and pull apart steamed pork buns to feed the dogs. Many are students like Sun Chenkai, who studies at Nanjing University of Finance and Economics. Sun says education is changing the way young people see animals.
We learn from textbooks about the bond between pets and humans. When you're in danger, your pet will come to your rescue. If kids are imbued with this concept, they would know animals are people's friends and we should not eat them.
Roadside rescues have sparked a heated debate about dog meat. Last summer, Shanghai TV aired a show on the issue in which dog lovers squared off against dog meat lovers, like this one.
I firmly support eating dog meat. Dog meat is fragrant. Dog meat is tasty. It's my favorite. My favorite.
Fan Xiantao runs a famous chain of dog meat stores and restaurants. He went on the TV show and defended his business.
I've been butchering dogs since I was 8 years old, and I still do it now. Do you know how many dogs I butcher every year? No less than 100,000.
Fan lives in Jiangsu Province's Pei County, where dog meat is a major industry. He says at least 500,000 dogs are slaughtered there annually. Last week, I caught up with Fan for coffee at a Starbucks in Shanghai. He wore a black baseball cap and a leather jacket. Fan insisted his methods are humane.
The way we butcher dogs is not very cruel. We have a traditional method that's very effective. Normally, we club them. We hit them in the head and kill them instantly.
When I ask what happens when the dog survives the first blow, Fan says one strike always works. He says Chinese have been eating dogs since ancient times, and there's no reason to stop now.
This is Asian or Chinese national culture. It is a national delicacy, and eating dog meat is a culinary tradition.
Fan dismisses the activists who want to outlaw his business. They're rather pathetic, he says. How can they stop dog trucks when they don't have money? Fan has a point. Money and sustainability are real issues for dog rescuers. Gao Jian works part-time at the shelter, which now cares for the dogs which were rescued in December. The shelter, really a sprawling dog farm in the mountains, already has too many animals people don't want.
So far, the monthly adoption situation is not very good, because among the 1,800-plus dogs here, the vast majority are farm dogs, and this type of dog isn't particularly liked in China. Many prefer purebreds.
Ha Wenjing founded this private shelter called Ping An Afu. She says it costs nearly $16,000 a year just to feed the dogs. Ha finances the operation through volunteer, corporate donations, and her own cash. She acknowledges that stopping trucks to prevent dog slaughter is unsustainable.
Relying on individual animal welfare organizations, hoping they can save 100 dogs every day, we really don't have that ability.
But that doesn't mean they won't keep trying. Ha says she and her supporters will keep working to raise money. So when they see another group of dogs headed to slaughter, they'll be able to act. Frank Langford, NPR News, Shanghai.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Beasley.